2021 broke records for the most journalists jailed in a year. China helped push up the numbers with a law called
Picking Quarrels and Provoking Trouble. Could you imagine how many New Yorkers would be arrested if you could prosecute people for picking quarrels and provoking trouble?
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Also this week, how true crime might not be just the sweet little binge that you think it is.
A lot of women that I talked to about true crime tell me that they're watching it for a sense of control, which I don't think that that's a particularly good way to look at it, though, because it's not going to give you tips on how to survive.
So true crime won't keep you breathing. But with mobsters in that racket, it might warm a few cold cases.
He was involved in 19 murders, and now he tells the tales of these crimes and many others from the Phoenix suburbs where he lives to be near his grandkids.
It's all coming up after this.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. How will you remember 2021? It was the year of the vaccine, the year of the insurrection, the year of American troops leaving Afghanistan, a year of worker strikes, deadly storms, televised courtroom verdicts, cryptomania, supply chain meltdowns, culture war spats, big public funding bills, and Omicron. More people died from COVID-19 this year than last. It's been a year of hope and anger and loss. In 2021, we at On the Media focused on the narratives, the ideas and beliefs that shape the news, more than the specific characters that deliver it. But as a whole, it's been a hard year for journalists. We asked our reporter, Micah Loewinger, to take stock of who and what the press lost this year. Micah, welcome.
Hey, Brooke.
Where should we begin?
I wanted to start with the story of a journalist named Danish Siddiqui. He's an Indian photojournalist with Reuters. Mm-hmm. His photos of violence in Hong Kong, Kashmir, Afghanistan, Iraq are at this point iconic. He actually won the Pulitzer Prize for feature photography in 2018 for his coverage of the Rohingya refugee crisis.
Yeah, I remember one of those pictures, an exhausted refugee touching the shore after crossing the border by boat. It's indescribably moving and indescribably beautiful.
Like so many of his photographs, it captures place, character, politics, pain, hope. You can't see the woman's face, but yet you seem to feel her.
Siddiqui was killed in July. He was embedded with Afghan forces when the soldiers were attacked by the Taliban.
He was injured by shrapnel, brought to a mosque for medical attention. And while he was there, the Taliban learned that there was a foreign journalist in the area. They found him there. They identified him as a Reuters reporter. They kidnapped him. They murdered him. And the Taliban released photos of his mutilated body, obviously to make a point to other media, to other governments, that if you come here, this is what we'll do to you.
Siddiqui, he was a special journalist, but he was also sort of a special case. He was a reporter for a major international news outlet. He entered the war zone on a dangerous assignment. That's not really the case for the majority of the 24 journalists who were murdered this year.
Yeah, when I was going through the list, I didn't recognize their names and I didn't recognize the outlets that they worked for. When I spoke to Robert Mahoney, who's the deputy executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, CPJ, he said that most of these reporters worked for very small outlets doing hyper-local coverage, often without the protection that comes with bigger outlets, without the training. He told me the story of a Mexican journalist named Gustavo Sanchez Cabrera,
who was working in a small town in Oaxaca State in the south of Mexico. This man ran a very small news service reporting on corruption, local killings, local protests. He upset some very powerful local people.
Last year, during the summer, he had been shot in an attempted assassination.
But he continued to report because he believed in what he was doing was serving his local community.
The Mexican government actually has a program where they offer protection to people like him, targets of political violence. That protection never came. And then this summer...
Now, he's riding on a motorcycle with his 15-year-old son when two men ram into the motorcycle. They then walk up and fire something like 15 bullets into him in front of his son. And his case is typical of so many local journalists around the world who are threatened but continue to do their work. Then they pay the ultimate price.
Tell me his name again, the name of this local reporter in Oaxaca.
Gustavo Sanchez Cabrera.
We also saw a record-breaking number of arrests of journalists. One case that got a lot of press was the Belarusian journalist Roman Petrusevich.
There's been a chorus of condemnation across Europe tonight after a Ryanair plane flying from Greece to Lithuania was diverted to Minsk in Belarus, and a dissident Belarusian journalist on board was detained. State media in Belarus said the plane was forced to land because of a bomb scare.
A Belarusian warplane, armed to the teeth, was dispatched to escort the aircraft in. But no bombs were found on board.
Dissident Roman Protasevich was paraded on pro-government TV, confessing to organizing mass riots.
The journalist's father said he believes his son has been beaten and his nose broken, disguised by makeup in the video, after that unprecedented hijacking.
293 journalists behind bars now. So tell me about a few of the others who were targeted this year.
Jimmy Lai.
Jimmy Lai, the owner of what used to be Hong Kong's most prominent pro-democracy newspaper, has been sentenced to another 13 months in jail following his conviction
for organizing a 2020 vigil commemorating the Tiananmen Square massacre. Critics say the charges are part of a crackdown on dissent.
For years, Hong Kong has been kind of like an island of media freedom. But last year, Beijing started cracking down on civil society in Hong Kong. China, for years, has been a prolific jailer of journalists, and this year they earned the top spot as the most aggressive jailer in the world. They also targeted a group of journalists who brought us the earliest coverage of coronavirus at a time way back when there was this mysterious flu or something in Wuhan. It really wasn't clear because there was such a tremendous media blackout. And one woman named Jiang Zhen,
she managed to get in and she started reporting on what was going on in the city, getting it out on social media and other platforms.
Robert Mahoney from CPJ.
In May of last year, she was brutally detained and charged with this really serious charge that the Chinese can bring against journalists called picking quarrels and provoking trouble. Could you imagine how many New Yorkers would be arrested if you could criminally prosecute people for picking quarrels and provoking trouble? She went on hunger strike, and then she was force-fed, trying to protest the fact that she was jailed for trying to tell the world what was going on with a global story.
This arrest rate, it's high, isn't it?
In the 40 years that CPJ has been collecting this data, they've never seen a number this high, almost 300 people. And I asked Robert Mahoney what accounted for this rise, and he said basically authoritarianism is coming back.
More and more governments want to stifle criticism. They want to shut down investigations into corruption and wrongdoing. Putting journalists in jail sends a message to other journalists that the same fate await them. And that brings about the cancer on journalism, which is self-censorship. Journalists don't report on subjects that they believe will get them arrested, jailed, even murdered.
So how about the American press? What are the trends in loss this year?
This year, we lost the Trump bump, which is
Bit of a double-edged sword, eh?
Yeah. The truth about the last 4 years is that Trump's open aggression on the American press was pretty frightening and disturbing, but it was also a really profitable time for basically all American media.
It made supporting the press a political act, an act of engagement.
Slate did kind of a roundup. They found that the New York Times doubled their subscriptions. The Washington Post tripled their subscriptions. Even our listens and donations at On the Media ballooned, right?
They did.
I emailed two media reporters at Axios, Neil Rothschild and Sarah Fisher, trying to quantify what the loss of the Trump bump looks like. In the first 6 months of 2021, mainstream outlets, New York Times, Washington Post, USA Today, they lost about 18.3% monthly traffic on average. Move to the right-leaning, left-leaning, and then more partisan outlets, you actually see a harder hit. For instance, outlets like Mother Jones lost around 42% of its traffic. Far-right outlets like Newsmax lost 43.8% of their traffic. Fox News viewership seemed to drop by over 20%. So seeing this universal hit to the news media feels like a kind of foreshadowing for the type of coverage we might see again when Trump, I think, inevitably runs for office in 2024.
Well, we don't know that.
I mean, come on. You know, it's like pretty odd. It seems
I don't think we know that, Micah.
Fair enough.
We'll see. The Trump years, though, did fill the coffers of the national news outlets. It was a much bleaker picture, though, for local outlets.
This is just the latest in a decades-long trend, but it's all been exacerbated by COVID. The Poynter Institute, which tracks the media industry, has counted dozens of newspaper closures over the past couple years. And among the ones that have closed this year, there's the McGregor Mirror, a Texas family-owned newspaper that's been around for over 100 years, closed 2 months ago. The Kokomo Perspective, it's an Indiana newspaper that shut down last month, and an alt-weekly called Style Weekly in Richmond, Virginia, a 40-year-old newspaper, shut down last month. And this is an interesting one because it was owned by Alden Global Capital.
No, I'm sorry, but we've followed Alden. It's a scourge. It bought the Tribune Publishing Company. It's a hedge fund. That's the very definition of vulture capitalism. How many people were cut from Tribune Publishing after Alden bought it for over $600 million.
They cut 250 people. So they'll cut the staff, reduce operating costs, sell off the assets, like the building the newspaper operates out of. And then they drive up the subscription prices. For a little while, you can basically trick subscribers into paying more for a crappier newspaper until the whole thing collapses. And a once beloved newspaper is destroyed, and Alden Global Capital is a little bit richer.
And in the past 15 years, more than a quarter of American newspapers have gone out of business.
And the ones that remain, about 50% of them, are owned by financial firms like Alden Global Capital.
Okay, so now the question that we always have to ask on a show as meta as ours. Why should we care?
Fewer people run for mayor in counties and in communities where a newspaper has shut down. Fewer people vote. A recent study published this summer from UC San Diego and Harvard found that newspaper closures are linked to higher rates of corporate corruption.
There are studies that have shown that political corruption, too, I mean, it seems obvious, goes up. And that frequently, this kind of corruption happens in plain sight because people aren't covering the public meetings or the state house sessions where it takes place.
And even just kind of like squishier social stuff, like obituaries, scores from high school sports games, job postings,
You're talking about the social glue.
The social glue that newspapers provide. When newspapers leave a community, where do people go to find that information? They either won't find it, or I think they seek out next door or local Facebook groups. And even coming from somebody like me who loves internet forums and has a sort of romantic idea of what online communities can achieve, I mean, local Facebook groups are toxic. They're filled with misinformation. They are not substitutes for real local reporting.
So the press has lost a lot this year. The lives of journalists, a loss of reporting due to self-censorship and imprisonment, the Trump bump, and the continued death of local news. So, Micah, as we greet the new year, what have we gained, if anything?
One thing we've definitely gained is a sense of solidarity.
How so?
Some data suggests that 2021 has seen the most new media unions in recent history. The New Yorker, Insider, iHeartMedia, The New York Times, public radio stations all across the country, journalists are forming unions to pressure their employers to offer better benefits, higher salaries, to address abusive managers and toxic workplaces. Even as our industry is kind of like falling apart, people are finding agency. And this isn't just some kind of inside baseball thing. I actually spoke to a professor at the University of Toronto, Nicole Cohen, who wrote a book called New Media Unions Organizing Digital Journalists. And she made an important point. Media unions are good for news consumers as well. And it makes sense. If you are working on some investigative project that takes months, if you're worrying the whole time about what your next gig is, or you don't have health insurance, or underpaid and working a part-time job, your muckraking is going to suffer, right?
You know, it's funny. That is maybe something we can take away from the Trump years and the pandemic years. They've increased some of the divisions among us, certainly. We've talked about those yawning chasms at length. But they've also brought groups of disparate people together. I mean, more people consider themselves workers now, in the old union sense of the word. And they realize that things don't have to stay the way they were. It happens across the board.
And one other thing we've gained this year, as journalists have started to have more open conversations with one another about the forces that threaten our industry, but also the forces that threaten the future of our democracy, is a sense of urgency. And I think we've lost some naivete.
With civil rights, voting rights, women's health care rights under attack, I think that the media has gained some awareness that democracy and human rights are actively being eroded at home.
This is Karen Atiyah, an editor at the opinion section at the Washington Post. And when I emailed her and asked her, what have we gained and lost this year, she sent me this voice memo.
And that the voices of Black, Latino women that have been warning us for years about America's dark domestic forces were right. So I hope that we lose for next year the pretense that both sidesism and neutrality will save us in the face of what's happening, because our very democracy is at stake.
You know, I don't like to end on tape, Micah, but just this once, I think I will.
Thank you.
Micah Loewinger is On the Media's reporter. Coming up, the myths and misdirection served up by true crime. This is On the Media.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. True crime is a blockbuster genre in, well, any medium. Books, movies, TV shows, and don't forget podcasts. All pull in the masses, horrifying and delighting us, and sometimes shaping our worldview in ways that bear no relation to reality. After all, how true is true crime? Does it really capture the complexity of the criminal mind, much less the criminal justice system, or convey the contexts of the victim and perpetrator in equal measure? Does it teach us anything at all? Emma Berquist is a young adult fiction writer and author of the recent Gawker article, True Crime is Rotting Our Brains. Last year, she was living in New Zealand, and one afternoon while walking her dog, a stranger lunged at her back and stabbed her multiple times. She survived the assault, but it fundamentally changed how she saw the genre she'd also avidly enjoyed. And in the Gawker piece, she pondered why it was so delicious, and also the hazards that come with the pleasure of consumption.
A lot of women that I talked to about true crime tell me that they're watching it for a sense of control, that it's a way of managing their fears, a way to like think about what they would do in those situations. Which I don't think that that's a particularly good way to look at it, though, because it's not...
terribly instructive?
Yeah. It's not going to give you tips on how to survive. But I do think that there is a sense of control in seeing these stories and how there's usually a narrative there, a beginning, a middle, and end. I think the problem becomes trying to maintain control can be ultimately very unhealthy. I was seeing this, you know, when I was dealing with my own PTSD, trying to impose control on something that can't really be controlled. And what happens is you get so caught up in making sure that you're in control that when something in your life inevitably does go sideways, it can really send you into a spiral.
In your case, it was a random event, but the assumption that hypervigilance can really deter these attacks is a kind of victim blaming.
First of all, it's a false assumption. There's no amount of hypervigilance that can save you from some sort of like surprise attack. And second of all, yeah, what I would call it is the victim blaming dressed up in empowerment, which is if I'm just smart enough or aware enough, I can escape these situations, unlike these other women who didn't. And, you know, what you're saying is that, you know, women who were murdered or women who had these horrible things happen to them should have known better or should have been more aware or should have been hypervigilant, and that would have protected them. You know, again, that's just blaming them for something that's completely outside their control.
Are you familiar with the study conducted by the University of Pennsylvania that found that the fear of crime and violence on TV have both increased over time, despite the crime rates declining, and that women reported more fear of crime on surveys than men?
Yeah. Again, I don't know that there's a direct correlation. I don't think it's quite that simple. But I do think that we are often unaware of the effect that the media that we consume on ourselves. We can see it in other people. We talk about our grandparents watching Fox News and things like that and how it can have an effect on them. But we don't always consider what we're watching and how it can have an effect on us, or what we're listening to and how it can kind of sneak itself into your brain and set up camp there.
Did you ever see that SNL song, The Husband is Going Out, and four women in the Saturday Night Live cast, their spouses are going out, and they're relieved because they get to...
I'm gonna watch a murder show, YouTube, Hulu, that's my favorite thing to do.
Twin sisters got killed on a cruise in the Bahamas. I'm gonna half watch it while I fold my pajamas.
Severed limbs found on a beach in Chula Vista, but I just kind of stare while I eat a piece of pizza.
They dig up some...
Women are, you know, the main consumers of it. And I don't know if women like watching true crime because true crime focuses on women, or if true crime focuses on women because women watch it and listen to it. And it's interesting because, you know, most murder victims are male, but most of the stories that we associate with true crime have female victims. I think that there's a kind of comfort in seeing your worst fears realized.
You had this horrible experience of random violence, and you are a true crime fan, And mm-hmm. you decided to write a piece about the problem. So what did you want to impart fundamentally?
Really what I wanted was for people to just sort of interrogate their relationship with true crime. I don't want anyone to feel guilty about watching it or consuming it because I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I don't want people to let it give them sort of the PTSD symptoms that I was struggling with. And I was seeing that happen in talking to my friends. I was seeing them have this fear that something bad was going to happen to them, just sort of like a low-level anxiety that they were just constantly living with.
How did that manifest?
Checking crime stats, having, you know, lots of security at their houses, thinking that they needed to have, like, weapons.
True crime is anecdotal. It's often overblown. It's like a newspaper that's all police blotter. But part of being a news consumer is looking for lessons, information, meaning from that stuff. Does true crime teach us anything useful?
I think if you're looking to true crime for survival tips, it's not going to be helpful. I think if you're looking at it for just information on, you know, maybe the justice system, that could be a little bit more helpful. There's a great article by Elon Green called The Enduring Pernicious Whiteness of True Crime. And he talks about how we should think more about what true crime can be and what we think about as crime. Because there are lots of ongoing crimes that we don't really think about as crime and aren't focused on as true crimes. Like when we think of theft, we think of, you know, people robbing a store, but we don't think about, you know, wage theft, which is a much larger scale crime, but we don't mm-hmm. think of that.
Wage theft is when the employers don't pay you what you're owed.
Right. Why do we focus on, you know, the small sort of shoplifting crimes? And why do we consider that crime? But we don't think about these huge corporations paying their workers, and they usually end up getting slapped with a lawsuit and they pay a fine and we keep going. If we were to sort of reevaluate what we think of as crime, we could learn a lot more from it.
But we don't fear those crimes. Those crimes aren't sexy. I'm talking about true crime podcasts and TV shows as they currently exist, what we can learn from those. And then a follow-up, how could we make those better without destroying their appeal?
I don't know if there's anything to learn from them other than maybe getting information on how to prevent crime from beginning in the first place. You know, look at what caused, you know, people to act the way they act. Was it domestic violence? Was it poverty? Can we find solutions that don't involve just putting someone in prison after the fact?
Mm-hmm.
I think that probably is the way true crime could be helpful.
So in these true crime podcasts, maybe the real information comes from focusing on the perpetrator and what impelled them to do what they did.
When we focus on the victim, you're getting to tell someone's story and, you know, giving them a legacy. But what is the point of true crime? Right now, it's just entertainment. And I think if it wanted to be something more profound, then it would need to focus on how to prevent these crimes from happening. And to do that, you probably need to focus on the criminal side of things.
Let me read you about a book that I recently came upon that I can't wait to order. Here's a little summary. When 18-year-old Lexi foresees the brutal murder of a young woman outside of a club in downtown L.A., she's powerless to stop it. But then the girl's ghost appears seeking vengeance, and Lexi's swept into a dangerous search that could put her directly into the path of a serial killer. With a touch, Lexi can sense how and when someone will die. Some say it's a gift, but to Lexi it's a curse, one that keeps her friendless and alone, and all that changes when Lexi foresees the violent death of a young woman, Jane, outside of a club.
Yeah, I did write that.
This is your book, Missing, Presumed Dead, from HarperCollins. It's steeped in violence, but it's a violence that teaches Lexi about herself.
I've always been interested in darker things. Like, I've always been a huge horror fan, and I wrote both of my books years before my attack. And I did end up killing someone with a knife in that book. And it's, yeah, it's just kind of strange how life works out. But yeah, I try not to include violence just for the sake of violence. I feel like you have to earn the gore and the violence that you're using. It either has to be part of the world that you're building, or it has to be something that's going to fundamentally change a character.
When did you know you weren't going to die?
I think it was when the woman found me on the path, and her name was Rupali, and we were able to talk months after my attack and reconnect. I had collapsed on the path, and I was bleeding a lot, and I couldn't get up. I had managed to call 111, which is the New Zealand number for the paramedics, and they were on the phone with me, but I was kind of having trouble focusing and talking, and Rupali walked by me, you know, and I just said, please help me. And she took my phone, and she was able to talk to the paramedics and sort of direct them to where we were. And I think just having someone else there, having just another human be next to me, I think that's when I knew. It was like, I'm going to get through this. I'm going to be okay. There's help coming.
So you still consume true crime a little bit?
Yeah, not quite at the extent that I did before. What I'm more interested now is in survival stories, stories of people overcoming very extreme situations. I went through a period where I read a lot of mountaineering books, and I read a lot about Chernobyl. I read about radiation poisoning, which I think could be considered, I guess I wouldn't say true crime, but it's often a crime when something goes wrong that could be prevented. I became very interested in stories of human beings overcoming very long odds, because my attack really did feel sort of like a natural disaster, like a strange thing that just tore into my life the way that like a tornado or a plane crash would.
Has it changed the way you write?
You know, fiction is such a different thing. And what happened to me, I don't think would make a great story, because there's not really a satisfactory ending. The one thing that I really wanted to get out of my attack was a reason, was an answer, sort of why, like why me, why then? And I never got that.
They've caught him, right?
Yeah, they did. But he was, even in court, he said, you know, I can't give you an answer about why. He didn't even know why. So I never really got that kind of closure or that kind of narrative conclusion. And I don't think I could write something that was so open-ended. I like to tie things up a little neater than that. And that's really, you know, the main difference between fiction and life is that we don't get those tidy endings in life.
So you wouldn't write about yours, but do you think that the experience change the subjects you'd want to write about? I mean, would you write a survival story?
Well, absolutely. And I did start one. And I also, you know, just finished a draft of a sort of killer in the woods kind of story. And that was really something that I started as a way to have a sort of cathartic outlet for the healing process. And I think I'll take what happened to me and use it to, you know, maybe put some more visceral scenes into my work, because I know what this feels like now. I know what the fear is like. I know what it's like to think that you're going to die. And I can, maybe putting that into a character's mind can help me sort of explore it more fully.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Emma Burquist is the author of the books Devils Unto Dust and Missing, Presumed Dead. You can find her recent article, True Crime is Rotting Our Brains, on Gawker. How about when tales of true crime are told by actual criminals? Coming up, mobster podcasts, now with real mobsters. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. So, true crime stories cut corners, misdirect. They squeeze complicated narratives into the shape of simple tales. But sometimes they can actually tie up some knotty and vexing loose ends. In fact, one kind of true crime show seems to offer the authorities, rather than us lay people, an offer they can't refuse. Rachel Corbett stumbled upon the phenomenon while working on an upcoming book about criminal profiling. The former FBI agents she called up kept talking about a new kind of podcast they were listening to, where the mobsters of a bygone era speak for themselves. Corbett's the author of an article in The New Yorker called Why the FBI Loves Mob Podcasts. And as it turns out, they are having quite a moment.
So they've all started in the last few years. Sammy the Bull is one of the fan favorites.
That's Salvatore Gravano, the Gambino family underboss in the late 80s, who you wrote was involved in at least 19 murders during his tenure as John Gotti's enforcer.
Exactly. He was the underboss, which means he was second in line if anything should have happened to Gotti. And he was a hitman, rose his way through the ranks, and he was involved in 19 murders, meaning he either executed them personally or he directed them. And now he tells the tales of these crimes and many others from the Phoenix suburbs where he lives to be near his grandkids.
You wrote he spent 17 and a half years at a supermax prison, but he's not still there. So he turned on Gotti, right?
Exactly. He flipped on Gotti. Gotti got caught implicating Gravano in a series of murders, and Sammy was angry that he wasn't the one who got pinched. Gotti did, but Gotti wanted him to do the time. So he flipped and went to the FBI and got Gotti put in prison for the rest of his life.
I wonder why he wasn't afraid to be murdered. Is it because he was with Gotti so long he knew exactly how and when it could come?
There was a hit out for him. I mean, there have been several hits out for him, I believe, since he ratted on Gotti. So it's not like he went scot-free, but he was in witness protection for a while. So he was safe then. And now I think he feels relatively safe because the guys he was running with at the time are now in their 70s and they're retired. It's really the Russian mob now, apparently, that's taking over. So I think they're all grandfathers or they're gone themselves.
And so what's his show like?
He tells war stories, basically. He's got this very slow voice, and he's, like I said, in his 70s.
When I think back about my past, I feel like I have lived three lifetimes. I grew up in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. I had loving parents, a great family. I was a happy kid.
He recounts his greatest hits, basically, when he ordered the execution of mob boss Paul Castellano, which was at the time a huge, colossal undertaking. No one killed one of their own bosses.
Right. He was Gotti's predecessor.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then he tells this case of the DEA agent that was killed by a mafia associate, which was one of the biggest cases in FBI history, one of the biggest manhunts in FBI history. He just goes through basically all the crimes he's involved with and is very happy to lay them out play by play. Sometimes cases that he wasn't involved with, but his associates were. And he just tells it in this very slow, very cinematic way. And it's kind of like watching a gangster movie. He's the real deal. He sounds like a gangster. He talks like a gangster. He still is one, of course.
But different stylistically is Jimmy Calandra, who was an enforcer for the Bonanno family, which you say is reportedly the most brutal of the five families who control organized crime in New York. His style in his YouTube series is very different.
Yeah, his a lot of airing of old grievances and score settlings and gripes about people. There's a lot of technical difficulties he's having with using YouTube, which is pretty funny. And he's always asking his subscribers to help him out with technical difficulties. But usually it's, a lot of scumbags and losers. And
that's his language is what you're saying. Or are those his guests?
Well, that's his language. That's who he's talking about.
You ain't no gentleman. I could tell you that. You're no gentleman. Nobody likes you. You got these kids. You got Hootie and the other drug addict attacking me. And if they did it to my face, they get drop kicked in the jaw. I tell you straight out.
He does a YouTube show, so you can see him, and he's often in a basement somewhere. He still wears the Adidas tracksuit.
sounds more like Wayne's World than, you know, Goodfellas.
Yeah, it's not very high tech.
And yet another style is one you mentioned, an interview show called The Sit Down with Michael Francis.
It's an interview show. He usually talks to actors who've been in various mobster movies.
And this is the second edition of Mob Movie Monday. As you know, we're alternating Mondays between Mob Movie Monday and Mob Story Monday. Today it's Mob Movie Monday. And today we're going to review Donnie Brasco.
I think he had the real Donnie Brasco on his show actually once. And he gives tips, you know, mafia lifestyle tips, how to, you know, how to live your best life if you want to join the mob, and business tips. He gives investment tips sometimes. He's a motivational speaker, so he gives kind of general, you know, how to be a better leader kind of tips.
What qualifies him to do this? Does he live in a van down by the river?
I think he's made a lot of money, and he's living in Orange County, having a pretty good life, actually. He's the son of Sonny Francis, who is a very famous mobster, and he was a former capo for the Colombo family. So he was pretty high ranking. He was more of a racketeer. Sammy would say he was a gangster. Michael Francis was a racketeer. So he was a big earner for the family.
Does every one of the five families have a representative in the podcast or media world?
Well, the ones I talked to were two guys from the Gambino. There's a Colombo. I didn't speak to anyone in the Lucchese or the Genovese families, but, you know, I would bet you there are.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke to maybe four of these guys, and that's just the tip of the iceberg.
You mentioned a famous case of the murder of a drug enforcement agency, undercover agent, that Sammy the Bull discussed, which was of tremendous interest to an FBI agent that you spent some time with for this story. His name is Fitzgerald.
Yeah, so he worked this case. This case was a huge deal because there was a sort of unspoken rule that the mafia didn't kill members of the FBI and the FBI didn't kill members of the mafia. Well, they didn't kill any federal agent. And so when this happened, it unleashed the biggest manhunt in New York history at the time. The feds just cracked down on every aspect of the mafia, their gambling rings, their clubs, and they just really put on all the pressure to try to find this guy who killed one of their own. This just wasn't supposed to happen.
You mean they went into places and said, "Nice club you got here. It'd be a shame if something happened to it."
I think more or less, yeah.
And Sammy the Bull said, you know, it made sense because this number one rule was broken. But then the mobsters and the FBI found themselves in a weird position over the death of this guy, competing to figure out who'd get him first.
Yeah, the mafia was really angry that this guy, who he wasn't a made guy, he was a low-level drug dealer. He's the one who killed the agent, and they were angry because now suddenly all their clubs were raided. The feds were breathing down their back, and so they wanted to catch this guy too and just get rid of him. That way the FBI would leave him alone, they hoped. So they were both hunting the guy. The FBI wanted to catch him in order to flip him, put him in jail, maybe get some more information out of him. The mafia didn't want that either, so they just wanted to kill him. And in the end, they're the ones who found him first.
Fitzgerald was very interested in this story, as Gravano told it, because there were so many unanswered questions.
Yeah, he personally worked this case. And of course, it was solved. They knew who killed the undercover agent, but they didn't know anything about him. They didn't know the circumstances. So it kind of fizzled. They didn't really get all of the details they were seeking. There were other murders associated with this case as well. You know, associates that died along the way, that the murderer, Gus Faraci was his name, was staying with. The mafia killed that guy. So all these questions about the circumstances were unanswered, and Gravano really goes through those in his podcast.
So did that give Fitzgerald closure?
Well, he certainly found it interesting. He was able to find out how they think when this is going on. He was surprised to hear, for example, that Sammy the Bull thought the FBI wanted them to murder him.
Yeah, it had a certain Beckett quality. Will no one rid us of this meddlesome murderer?
Exactly. Of course, they didn't want him to die. They wanted information. But, you know, the mob operates how the mob operates. And so it's not that he really found out material details, some of them knew they can prosecute, but it was a lot of color and context and understanding that they gather from just hearing it from the other side of the issue.
My wife answered the door, and she said, Sammy, there's FBI by the door. I went to the door, and I says, what can I do for you? He says, Sammy, we want you to tell John Gotti that we want this guy found, and we don't care how. The way they said it, I just had to ask the question. Are you asking me to kill him? Oh, no, no, Sammy. No, you know, we're not going there. But we don't give a fuck how he's found.
They close cases, but they live on in their minds. And I think that the curiosities go on, even if it's in the past and the books are closed.
Does Fitzgerald have a podcast?
He does.
Yeah? What do you think of it?
It's great. I mean, it's a different tone for sure, but he also goes through the biggest cases of his career. He's one of the agents who was on the Unabomber task force. Mm. He did the linguistic analysis. So he talks about, you know, huge cases that he's worked, and you get a lot of insight into those as well.
So he's a profiler.
Exactly.
You mentioned that these mafia guys have different styles, but is there more of an emphasis on graphic storytelling or of romanticizing the days of the wise guys and the mafia code?
I think it's very much both. They would tell you they're not romanticizing the wise guy spirit, but it's hard for me to see how they're not in a way. It's telling stories about all the money they had and the women they had and all the lifestyle and, of course, the gruesome violence, too. One of the guys I talked to, John Alight, says specifically to me that he does not want to glamorize the lifestyle. In fact, his whole purpose is to teach kids not to join gangs and to stay away from a life of crime.
John Alight was also a hitman for Gotti.
Exactly. Yeah, kind mm-hmm. of the next generation after Sammy the Bull. But at the same time, you know, he sells signed baseball bats on his website because he was very notorious for using the baseball bat in his jobs.
Of all of the performers you've encountered, who's your favorite?
I have to say Sammy the Bull, just because there's something very charming about his style. He's got this just slow voice. It's kind of soothing in a way. And he's, you know, he sounds like he could be in a movie. He's really transports you. You know, if you like mobster movies, which I happen to, it feels like you're watching one. Of course, it's the real thing. I mean, you know, and I guess that's maybe why these guys have been so successful, because they are often charming. You know, one of the agents told me he had to always remind himself when he's hanging out with them in the club that they would not hesitate to kill him in another situation. Mm-hmm. They're smiling and laughing and they actually like each other, but there's another side, of course.
It's just business.
Exactly. That's what the podcasts are, too. I think they found another way to earn on the other side.
How does the FBI segment of the Mafia podcast demographic listen differently from just a regular person? Are they trying to decode these things?
I think so. They're not just listening for a wild ride of a story. They already know the story. I think they're listening for details that they didn't know. One agent told me that he was really interested in the psychology of the Mafia. Mm-hmm. These guys are known for not speaking, of course. They take a code of silence. So it was always very hard to get them to talk, and now suddenly they're opening up about everything, in some cases about how they feel and what they were thinking at the time and what motivated them. And then the other agent told me he was really kind of listening for clues about old cases, just to shade in what actually happened and put pieces together.
Is he the guy who also listens for what's being left out?
Yeah, Fitzgerald said that. Because in that Sammy the Bull episode about the DEA agent, he doesn't mention a murder that happened. One of the men who was housing Gus Faraci, who killed the agent, was also killed. And Fitzgerald thinks that Sammy very likely knew who did it, if not wasn't involved in it himself. Because they can talk about anything that they confess to. They have legal immunity to any crimes that they confess to. But if they didn't confess to a crime, then, of course, they really shouldn't be talking about it. So if they're not talking about something on their show, you know, one might infer that maybe that's something they were involved in.
You know, part of the beauty of podcasting is it's an open medium. Anyone can give their side of the story. How much trust do you think one should put into the words of even retired mafia bosses?
you should probably be skeptical. I think that's safe to say. I think there's a lot of aggrandizing that goes on of oneself and one's legacy as they look back. And, you know, they watch mobster movies too. And I think that, you know, everyone wants to live up to a certain image and, you know, and retell the story the way they want to. And who's going to know the truth, you know?
Are you a true crime fan yourself?
I am. I'm writing a book about criminal profiling right now, so I confess I consume a lot of this media myself. It's probably rot for your brain.
All right, so we'll call you when we do our full hour on true crime podcasts, but thank you very much for this.
Oh, please do. Thank you so much.
Well, you woke up this morning, got yourself a gun. Your mama always said you'd be there. Chosen one, she said you're one in a million. You got to burn a shine, but you were a born under a bad sign with a blue moon in your eyes.
And that's our show. On the Media is produced by Micah Loewinger, Eloise Blondio, Rebecca Clark Callender, and Eli Cohen, with help from Juwaria Wright. Zandra Ellen writes our magnificent newsletter, and our show is edited by me and Kat. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Adrian Lilly. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, New Year, Snovim Godom. Bye.
Got yourself a gun. Got yourself a gun.